It's all the king's money. His image is on it. Mary, look. He takes her hand. I could not dissuade him from his liking for you. He...
How hard did you try?
I wish you were safe with us. Though, of course, it was not the great match you might expect as the Queen's sister.
I doubt there are many sisters who expect what I receive, nightly.
She will get another child by Henry, he thinks. Anne will have it strangled in the cradle. Your friend William Stafford is at court. At least, I think he is still your friend.
Imagine how he likes my situation. Still, at least I get a kind word from my father. Monseigneur finds he needs me again. God forbid the king should ride a mare from any other stable.
This will end. He will free you. He will give you a settlement, a pension. I'll speak for you.
Does a dirty dishcloth get a pension?
Mary sways on the spot. She seems dazed with misery and fatigue. Great tears swell in her eyes. He stands, catching them, dabbing them away, whispering to her and soothing her, and wanting to be elsewhere. When he breaks free, he gives her a backward glance, as she stands in the doorway, desolate. Something must be done for her, he thinks. She's losing her looks. Henry watches from a gallery high above Westminster Hall. As his queen takes her seat in the place of honour, her ladies around her, the flower of the court and the nobility of England. The king has fortified himself earlier, and is picking at a spice plate, dipping thin slices of apple into cinnamon. In the gallery with him, encore les ambassadeurs, Jean de Danteville, furred against the June chill, and his friend the Bishop of Lavour, wrapped in a fine brocade gown.
"This has all been most impressive, Cromwell," de Selve says.
Astute brown eyes study him, taking everything in. He takes in everything too, stitching and padding, studding and dyeing. He admires the deep mulberry of the bishop's brocade. They say these two Frenchmen favour the gospel, but favour at Françoise's court extends no further than a small circle of scholars that the king, for his own vanity, wishes to patronise. He has never quite been able to grow his own Thomas More, his own Erasmus, which naturally piques his pride.
"Look at my wife, the Queen!"
Henry leans over the gallery. He might as well be down there.
"She's worth a show, is she not?"
"I have had all the windows reglazed," he says. "The better to see her."
"Fiat lux," de Selve murmurs. "She has done very well," de Danteville says. "She must have been 6 hours on her feet today. One must congratulate your majesty in obtaining a queen who is as strong as a peasant woman. I mean no disrespect, of course."
In Paris they are burning Lutherans. He would like to take it up with the envoys, but he cannot while the odour of roast swan and peacock drifts up from below.
Monsieur,
he asks, music rising around them like a shallow tide, silver ripples of sound. Do you know of the man Guido Camillo? I hear he's at your master's court. De Selve and his friend exchange glances. This has thrown them.
The man who builds the wooden box... Jean murmurs.
Oh, yes. It is a theatre, he says. De Selve nods.
In which you yourself are the play.
Erasmus has written to us about it, Henry says, over his shoulder. He is having the cabinet makers create him little wooden shelves and drawers, one inside another. It is a memory system for the speeches of Cicero. With your permission, he intends it as more than that. It is a theatre on the ancient Vitruvian plan, but it is not to put on plays. As my lord the bishop says, you as the owner of the theatre are to stand in the centre of it and look up. Around you there is arrayed a system of human knowledge, like a library, but as if... Can you imagine a library in which each book contains another book, and a smaller book inside that? Yet it is more than that. The king slips into his mouth an aniseed comfit and snaps down on it.
Already there are too many books in the world. There are more every day.
One man cannot hope to read them all.
I do not see how you understand so much about it, de Selve says. All credit to you, Maître Cramwell. Guido will only speak his own Italian dialect, and even in that he stammers.
If it pleases your master to spend his money, Henry says. He is not a sorcerer, is he, this Guido? I should not like Francis to fall into the hands of a sorcerer. By the way, Cromwell, I'm sending Stephen back to France.
Stephen Gardiner.
So the French do not like doing business with Norfolk.
Not surprising.
His mission will be of some duration.
De Selve catches his eye.
But who will do Master Secretary's job?
Oh, Cromwell will do it, won't you?
Henry smiles. He is hardly down into the body of the hall before Master Risley intercepts him. This is a big day for the heralds and their officers, their children and their friends. Fat fees coming their way. He says so, and Callmy says, fat fees coming your way. He edges back against the screens, voice low. One could foresee this, he says, because Henry is tired of it. Winchester's grinding opposition to him every step of the way. He is tired of arguing. Now he is a married man. He looks for a little more douceur. With Anne, he says, and Cormie laughs. You know her better than me. If, as they say, she is a lady with a sharp tongue, then all the more he needs ministers who are kind to him. So devote yourself to keeping Stephen abroad, and in time he will confirm you in the post. Christoph, dressed up for the afternoon, is hovering nearby, making signals to him. You will excuse me, he says, but Risley touches his gown of crimson, as if for luck, and says, you are the master of the house, and the master of the revels. You are the origin of the king's happiness. You have done what the cardinal could not, and much more besides. Even this, he gestures around him, to where the nobility of England, having already eaten their words, are working through 23 dishes. Even this feast has been superbly managed. No one need call for anything. It is all at his hand before he thinks of it. He inclines his head. Risley walks away, and he beckons the boy. Christoph says, one tells me to impart nothing of confidence in the hearing of Cormy.
As Ralph says, he got cheat tried to Gardiner with anything he can get.
Now, sir, I have a message. You must go quick to the Archbishop. When the feast is done, he glances up to the dais where the Archbishop sits beside Anne, under her canopy of state. Neither of them is eating, though Anne is pretending to. Both of them are scanning the hall. I go trip-trot, he says. He is taken with the phrase. Where?
His old lodging, which he says you know. He wishes you to be secret. He says not to bring any person.
Well, you can come, Christoph. You're not a person. The boy grins. He is apprehensive. Does not quite like the thought of the abbey precincts. The drunken crowds at dusk, without somebody to watch his back. Unfortunately, a man cannot have two fronts. They have almost reached Cranmer's lodging when fatigue enwraps his shoulders, an iron cloak. Pause for a moment, he says to Christoph. He has hardly slept these last nights. He takes a breath in shadow. Here it is cold, and as he passes into the cloisters he is dipped in night. The rooms around are shuttered, empty, no sound from within. From behind him, an inchoate shouting from the Westminster streets like the cries of those lost after a battle. Cranmer looks up. He is already at his desk.
These are days we will never forget, he says. No one who's missed it would believe it. The king spoke warm words in your praise today. I think it was intended I should convey them.
I wonder why I ever gave any thought to the cost of brick-making for the tower. It seems such a small item now. And tomorrow the jousts. Will you be there? My boy, Richard, is listed for the bouts on foot, fighting in single combat.
He will prevail, Christoph declares. Biff! And one is flat, never to rise again.
Hush, Cranmer says. You are not here, child. Cromwell, please.
He opens a low door at the back of the chamber. He dips his head, and framed by the doorway in the half-light he sees a table, a stool, and on the stool a woman sitting, young, tranquil, her head bowed over a book. She looks up.
Ich bitte Sie, ich brauche eine Kerze.
Christoph, a candle for her.
The book before her he recognizes. It is a tract of Luther's.
May I, he says, and picks it up.
He finds himself reading. His mind leaps along the lines. Is she some fugitive Cranmer is sheltering? Does he know the cost if she is taken? He has time to read half a page before the Archbishop trickles in like a late apology.
This woman is, Cranmer says,
Margareta, my wife.
Dear God!
He slams Luther down on the table.
What have you done? Where did you find her? Germany, evidently.
This is why you were slow to return.
I see it now.
Why? Cranmer says meekly.
I could not help it.
Do you know what the king will do to you when he finds you out? The master executioner of Paris has devised a machine with a counterweighted beam, shall I draw it for you, which, when a heretic is burned, dips him into the fire and lifts him out again, so that the people can see the stages of his agony. Now Henry will be wanting one. Or he will get some device to tease your head off your shoulders over a period of 40 days.
The young woman looks up.
Mein Onkel.
Who is that?
She named a theologian, Andreas Osiander, a Nuremberger, a Lutheran. Her uncle and his friend, she says, and the learned men of her town, they believe...
It may be the belief in your country, madam, that a pastor should have a wife, but not here. Did Dr. Cranmer not warn you of this?
Please, Cranmer begs. Tell me what she is saying. Does she blame me? Is she wishing herself at home?
No. No, she says you are kind.
What took hold of you, man?
I told you I had a secret.
So you did. Down the side of the page.
But to keep her here, under the king's nose.
I have kept her in the country, but I could not refuse her wish to see the celebrations.
She's been out on the streets.
Why not? No one knows her.
True. The protection of the stranger in the city. One young woman in a cheerful cap and gown. One pair of eyes among the thousands of eyes. You can hide a tree in a forest. Cranmer approaches him. He holds out his hands, so lately smeared with the sacred oil. Fine hands, long fingers, the pale rectangles of his palms crossed and recrossed by news of sea voyages and alliances.
I asked you here as my friend, for I count you my chief friend, Cromwell, in this world.
So there is nothing to do in friendship, but to take these bony digits in his own.
Very well. We will find a way. We will keep your lady's secret. I only wonder that you did not leave her with her own family, till we can turn the king our way.
Margareta is watching them, blue eyes flitting from face to face. She stands up. She pushes the table away from her. He watches her do it, and his heart lurches. Because he has seen a woman do this before, his own wife. And he has seen how she puts her palms down on the surface to haul herself up. Margareta is tall, and the bulge of her belly juts above the tabletop.
Jesus, he says.
I hope for a daughter,
the Archbishop says.
About when?
He asks Margareta. Instead of answering, she takes his hand. She places it on her belly, pressing it down with her own. At one with the celebrations, the child is dancing. Spanoletta, estampi royale. This is perhaps a foot. This is a fist.
You need a friend, he says, a woman with you.
Cranmer follows him as he pounds out of the room.
About John Frith,
he says.
What?
Since he was brought to Croydon, I have seen him 3 times in private conversation. A worthy young man, a most gentle creature. I have spent hours, I regret not a second of it, but I cannot turn him from his path.
He should have run into the woods. That was his path.
We do not all...
Cranmer drops his gaze.
Forgive me, but we do not all see as many paths as you.
So you must hand him to Stokesley now, because he was taken in Stokesley's diocese.
I never thought, when the king gave me this dignity, when he insisted I occupy this seat, that among my first actions would be to come against a young man like John Frith, and to try to argue him out of his faith.
Welcome to this world below.
I cannot much longer delay,
Cranmer says. Nor can your wife.
The streets around Austin Friars are almost deserted. Bonfires are starting up across the city, and the stars are obscured by smoke. His guards are on the gate, sober, he is pleased to note. He stops for a word. There is an art to being in a hurry but not showing it. Then he walks in and says, I want Mistress Barr. Most of his household have gone to see the bonfires, and they will be out till midnight dancing. They have permission to do this. Who should celebrate the new queen if they do not? John Page comes out. Something want doing, sir? William Brabazon, pen in hand, one of Wolsey's old crew. The king's business never stops. Thomas Avery, fresh from his accounts. There's always money flowing in, money flowing out. When Wolsey fell, his household deserted him, but Thomas Cromwell's servants stayed to see him through. A door bangs overhead. Rafe comes down, boots clattering, hair sticking up. He looks flushed and confused.
Sir?
I don't want you. Is Helen here, do you know?
Why?
At that moment, Helen appears. She is fastening up her hair under a clean cap.
I need you to pack a bag and come with me.
For how long, sir?
I cannot say.
To go out to London?
He thinks. I'll make some arrangement. The wives and daughters of men in the city, discreet women, they will find her servants and a midwife, some competent woman who will put Cranmer's child into his hands. Perhaps for a short time.
The children?
We will take care of your children. She nods, speeds away. You wish you had men in your service as swift as she. Rafe calls after her.
Helen!
He looks irate.
Where's she going, sir? You can't just drag her off into the night.
Oh, I can, he says mildly.
I need to know.
Believe me, you don't. He relents. Or if you do, this is not the time. Rafe, I'm tired. I'm not going to argue.
He could perhaps leave it to Christoph and some of the more unquestioning members of his household to take Helen from the warmth of Austin Friars to the chill of the Abbey precincts. Or he could leave it till the morning. But his mind is alive to the loneliness of Cranmer's wife, the strangeness of the city en fête, the deserted aspect of Cannon Row, where even in the shadow of the Abbey robbers are bound to lurk. Even in the time of King Richard, the district was home to gangs of thieves, who issued out by night at their pleasure, and when the dawn came, swarmed back to claim the privilege of sanctuary, and no doubt to share the spoils with the clergy. I shall clean out that lot, he thinks. My men will be after them like ferrets down a hole. Midnight. Stone exhales a mossy breath. Flagstones are slippery with the city's exhalations. Helen puts her hand into his. A servant admits them, eyes downcast. He slips him a coin to raise his eyes no higher. No sign of the Archbishop. Good. A lamp is lit. A door pushed ajar. Cranmer's wife is lying in a little cot. He says to Helen, Here is a lady who needs your compassion. You see her situation. She does not speak English. In any case, you need not ask her name. Here is Helen, he says. She has two children of her own. She will help you. Mistress Cranmer, her eyes closed, merely nods and smiles. But when Helen places a gentle hand on her, she reaches out and strokes it.
Where is your husband?
Er betet. I hope he is praying for me.
The day of Frith's burning, he is hunting with the king over the country outside Guildford. It is raining before dawn, a gusty, tugging wind bending the treetops.
raining all over England, soaking the crops in the fields. Henry's mood is not to be dented. He sits down to write to Anne, left back at Windsor. After he has twirled his quill in his fingers, turned his paper about and about, he loses the will. "You write it for me, Cromwell. I'll tell you what to put. A tailor's apprentice is going to the stake with Frith, Andrew Hewitt. Catherine used to have relics brought to her, Henry says, for when she was in labour with her children. A girdle of the Blessed Virgin. I hired it. I don't think the Queen will want that. And special prayers to St. Margaret. These are women's things. Best left to them, sir." Later, he will hear that Frith and the boys suffered, the wind blowing the flames away from them repeatedly. Death is a japester. Call him, and he will not come. He is a joker, and he lurks in the dark, a black cloth over his face. There are cases of the sweat in London. The king, who embodies all his people, has all the symptoms every day. Now Henry stares at the rain falling. Cheering himself up, he says, "It may abate. Jupiter is rising. Now tell her, tell the queen." He waits, his pen poised. "No, that's enough. Give it to me, Thomas. I will sign it." He waits to see if the king will draw a heart. But the frivolities of courtship are over. Marriage is a serious business. Henricus Rex. "I think I have a stomach cramp," the king says. "I think I have a headache. I feel queasy, and there are black spots before my eyes. That's a sign, isn't it?" "If your majesty will rest a little," he says, "and take courage. You know what they say about the sweat. Merry at breakfast, dead by dinner. But you know it can kill you in 2 hours. He says, "I have heard that some people die of fear." By afternoon the sun is struggling out. Henry, laughing, spurs away his hunter under the dripping trees. At Smithfield, Frith is being shovelled up, his youth, his grace, his learning, and his beauty. A compaction of mud, grease, charred bone. The king has two bodies. The first exists within the limits of his physical being. You can measure it, and often Henry does. His waist, his calf, his other parts. The second is his princely double. Free-floating, untethered, weightless, which may be in more than one place at a time. Henry may be hunting in the forest while his princely double makes laws. One fights, one prays for peace. One is wreathed in the mystery of his kingship. One is eating a duckling with sweet green peas. The Pope now says his marriage to Anne is void. He will excommunicate him if he does not return to Catherine. Christendom will slough him off, body and soul, and his subjects will rise up and eject him into ignominy, exile. No Christian hearth will shelter him, and when he dies his corpse will be dug with animal bones into a common pit. He has taught Henry to call the Pope the Bishop of Rome, to laugh when his name is mentioned. If it is uncertain laughter, it is better than his former genuflection. Cranmer has invited the prophetess, Elizabeth Barton, to a meeting at his house in Kent. She has seen a vision of Mary, the former princess, as queen. Yes. Of Gertrude, Lady Exeter, as queen. Yes. He says gently, "Both cannot be true." The maid says, "I only report what I see." He writes that she is bouncing and full of confidence. She is used to dealing with archbishops, and she takes him for another Warham, hanging on her every word. She's a mouse under the cat's paw. Queen Catherine is on the move, her household much reduced to the Bishop of Lincoln's palace at Buckton, an old red brick house with a great hall, and gardens that run out into the copses and fields and so into the fenland landscape. September will bring her the first fruits of autumn, as October will bring the mists. The king demands that Catherine give up for his coming child the robes in which the child Mary was christened. When he hears Catherine's answer, he, Thomas Cromwell, laughs. "Nature wronged Catherine," he says, "in not making her a man. She would have surpassed all the heroes of antiquity." A paper is put before her, in which she is addressed as Princess Dowager. shocked. They show him how her pen has ripped through it as she scores out the new title. Rumours crop in the short summer nights. Dawn finds them like mushrooms in the damp grass. Members of Thomas Cromwell's household have been seeking a midwife in the small hours of the morning. He's hiding a woman at some country house of his, a foreign woman who has given him a daughter. "Whatever you do," he says to Rafe, "don't defend my honour. I have women like that all over the place." "They will believe it," Rafe says. "The word in the city is that Thomas Cromwell has a prodigious..." "Memory," he says. "I have a very large ledger. A huge filing system in which are recorded under their name and also under their offence, the details of people who have cut across me. All the astrologers say that the king will have a son. But you are better not to deal with these people. A man came to him, months ago, offering to make the king a philosopher's stone. And when he was told to make himself scarce, he turned rude and contrary, as these alchemists do, and now gives it out that the king will die this year. Waiting in Saxony, he says, is the eldest son of the late King Edward. You thought him a rattling skeleton beneath the pavements of the tower. Only his murderer is nowhere. You are deceived, for he is a man grown and ready to claim his kingdom. He counts it up. King Edward V, were he living, would be 64 this November coming. He's a bit late to the fight, he says. He puts the alchemist in the tower to rethink his position. No more from Paris. Whatever Maitre Guido's up to, he's very quiet about it. Hans Holbein says, Thomas, I've got your hands down, but I haven't paid much attention to your face. I promise this autumn I'll finish you off. Suppose within every book there is another book, and within every letter on every page, another volume constantly unfolding. But these volumes take no space on the desk. Suppose knowledge could be reduced to a quintessence, held within a picture, a sign, held within a place which is no place. Suppose the human skull were to become capacious, spaces opening inside it, humming chambers like beehives. Lord Mountjoy, Catherine's chamberlain, has sent him a list of all the necessities for the confinement of a Queen of England. It amuses him, the smooth and civil handover, the court and its ceremonies roll on, whoever the personnel. But it is clear, Lord Mountjoy takes him as the man in charge of everything now. He goes down to Greenwich and refurbishes the apartments, ready for Anne. Proclamations, undated, are prepared, to go out to the people of England and the rulers of Europe, announcing the birth of a prince. "Just leave a little gap," he suggests, "at the end of prince, so, if need be, you can squash in..." But they look at him as if he's a traitor, so he leaves off. When a woman withdraws to give birth, the sun may be shining, but the shutters of her room are closed, so she can make her own weather. She's kept in the dark so she can dream. Her dreams drift her far away from terra firma to a marshy tract of land, to a landing stage, to a river where a mist closes over the further bank, and earth and sky are inseparate. There she must embark towards life and death, a muffled figure in the stern directing the oars. In this vessel, prayers are said that men never hear. Bargains are struck between a woman and her God. The river is tidal, and between one feather stroke and the next, her tide may turn. On the 26th of August, 1533, a procession escorts the Queen to her sealed rooms at Greenwich. Her husband kisses her, adieu and bon voyage. And she neither smiles nor speaks. She is very pale, very grand, a tiny jewelled head balanced on the swaying tent of her body, her step small and circumspect, a prayer book in her hands. On the quay, she turns her head, one lingering glance. She sees him, she sees the Archbishop. One last look, and then, her women steadying her elbows, she puts her foot into the boat. Chapter 2. Devil's Spit.
Autumn and Winter, 1533.